Welcome back to the program. Over the course of his remarkable career, best-selling novelist Chris Bohjalian has taken readers on a spectacular array of journeys. He's brought us to an isolated farmhouse in Vermont, the roaring 20s on Long Island, and the last 6 months of World War II in Poland and Germany. Now in his 15th book, The Sandcastle Girls, he brings us on a very different journey, a sweeping historical love story steeped in his own Armenian heritage and set against the backdrop of the Armenian Genocide in 1915. It is my pleasure to welcome Chris Bohjalian back to this program to talk about his new novel, The Sandcastle Girls. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for having me back on.
Delight to have you here. This is a real personal book for you, obviously not only with respect to your Armenian heritage, but in terms of your grandparents and how it relates to the story that you're telling.
It is. This is the most important book I think I will ever write. And I think you're right. It is the most personal. When I was writing this novel, I kept beside my desk a photograph of Leo and Haigri Bohjalian, my Armenian grandparents, who are both genocide survivors. And while we know bits and pieces of their lives, what they experienced, what they endured, we don't know many of the details, and because they didn't talk about it very, very much. And I think that's one of the reasons why The Sandcastle Girls, to a certain extent, is a mystery. It's about an Armenian-American novelist at midlife who knows far too little about her ancestry and is trying to unravel the mysteries of her grandparents.
Growing up, even through your grandparents, what did you know? What did you understand about the Armenian Genocide?
I understood a little. My father was a first-generation American. He grew up in a house speaking Armenian and Turkish, so much so that when he started kindergarten, he couldn't speak enough English to ask where the boys' room was. And so, like many first-generation Americans, he reinvented himself and wanted to be as American as possible. And I remember, for example, when I was a little boy, my mother saying things like, Chris, finish your food. Think of the starving Armenians, that classic expression. And I remember my father once saying, starving Armenians, why doesn't anyone say, think of these starving Bangladeshis? Why doesn't anyone think of the starving Cambodians? Why is it always the starving Armenians? I don't think I'm particularly hungry. And this was his, I think, defensiveness and the idea that he wanted to be an American and he didn't want to be perceived as a victim. That's how little the Armenian Genocide was really discussed in my house growing up, and which is just astonishing when you think about the fact that Leo and Haigri Bohjalian were genocide survivors.
One of the things about the genocide that's so remarkable is that historically, you go back, and it was covered profoundly at the time, and yet the aftermath of it really never stuck. It never stayed. And in fact, arguably, it was one of the reasons Hitler believed he could get away with what he got away with.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. There's a direct link between the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust and the Cambodian killing fields, Bosnia and Rwanda and Darfur, and you get the point. And yes, you're also right that once upon a time, people knew. The New York Times ran 145 articles about the massacres and the slaughters in the First World War, culminating in the July 1919 front page story about the conviction and the sentencing to death of Talat Pasha, Jamal Pasha, and Enver Pasha for crimes against humanity. What I think unfortunately happened was the Ataturk government took over in the early 1920s and wanted to be perceived as Western and democratic and forward-thinking, and the barbarism of the Armenian genocide didn't fit that profile, so it got shuffled under the rug. Armenia became a part of the Soviet Republic. The news cycles moved on. As my narrator asks in the novel, how do you kill 1.5 million people with nobody knowing? You kill them in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere, and that's what happened. So by the 1930s, by 1939, as you pointed out, Hitler was able to tell his commanders on the eve of the assault on Poland, be merciless. No one remembers the annihilation of the Armenians.
Even to this day, the denial of the Turkish government of the genocide really prevented any truth and reconciliation from ever happening.
You know, I think you're onto something there, too. I once heard Gerda Weissman-Klein speaking at the University of Texas Hillel. Goethe wrote the amazing memoir, All But My Life, of her survival in two Nazi concentration camps and on two forced marches. And during the question and answer, a student said to her, "What do you say to Holocaust deniers?" And she shrugged and said, "I tell them to ask Germany what happened. Germany doesn't deny it." And that's, I think, a really big difference between the Holocaust and the Armenian Genocide. Turkey still refuses to recognize what occurred between 1915 and 1918. So, for example, an Armenian can't say to somebody, "What do you say to deniers of the Armenian Genocide?" We can't say, "Ask Turkey," because Turkey will simply deny it.
One of the things that sort of runs through the Sandcastle Girls also in terms of your main character, Laura, is this sense of needing to find out what that history was, this sense of unresolved history that she finally encounters.
Yep. And there's a lot of that in me. Armin Petrosian, my Armenian engineer in 1915, and Elizabeth Endicott, my graduate of Mount Holyoke College, who journeys into Aleppo, Syria on an American aid mission to the Armenians, are not Leo and Haigui Bokjali, my grandparents. But Laura's sense of wonder about who her grandparents really were mirrors my wonder at midlife about who Leo and Haigui Bokjalian really were and what they experienced 95 to 100 years ago. What were their stories?
And talk about how that's impacted you, do you think, this sense of not knowing the history for so long?
You know, it's affected me more and more as I was a father myself. When I look at my beautiful daughter, who's 18 now, and what does she know about her grandparents? What does she know about her great-grandparents? What are the stories that I want her to know to someday pass on to her children? I don't know whether this is a midlife thing, but I'm certainly far more focused now on my family history than I was as a narcissistic, self-absorbed young man.
And this sense of the other world, the sense of looking out beyond your world, for example, in Vermont. Talk about that juxtaposition, that small town world versus sort of the scope of the story.
Yeah, I do. I live in a tiny Vermont village, barely a 1,000 people. And it's halfway up a mountain, Vermont's third highest mountain. And when I was in Armenia, and when I was in Lebanon earlier this year, I found myself thinking in terms of villages and thinking in terms of small towns. One of the reasons I wanted to get to Lebanon was I wanted to get to Anjar. Anjar is where the descendants of the Armenian survivors of Musadeh live. And Musadeh, the shorthand of those of you who don't know the story of Musadeh, 4,000 Armenians refused to be deported, held off the Turkish army for 53 days before the French rescued them, and they were resettled in Anjar. There was a panel on a mural in a community room in Anjar of a mountain, and in Armenian it says underneath it, "Let them come again. We are still the mountain." And it's certainly a rallying cry, a remembrance of the Armenian fighters who refused to be deported in 1915. But I love that "we are still the mountain" portion as well, because it's a reference, I think, to the diaspora. Of the 10 million Armenians in this world, only 3 million live in Armenia. The rest of us live in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Lincoln, Vermont or Beirut, Lebanon, Paris, France. But wherever we are still the mountain. We are villages that are trying to retain some semblance of a national identity and a national heritage.
And it's interesting that when the genocide started in April of 1915, that the first thing the Turks did was to try and silence the culture more than anything else. I mean, it was that culture, the voices of the culture, that they wanted to silence initially.
Yeah, it all began on April 24th. Well, it didn't all officially begin. It officially began the way we commemorate on April 24th, 1915, with a roundup in Constantinople of the Armenian intelligentsia, the educators, the journalists, the religious leaders, most of whom would die over the subsequent 6 months in the deserts, between Constantinople and Syria.
One of the things you touched on this earlier was the sheer brutality that took place during the genocide. Talk a little bit about that and the way you've incorporated some of it into Sandcastle Girls.
Yeah, it was brutal. And it was brutal in ways that would both be a precursor to the Holocaust and in ways that were far more primitive and barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
The precursors to the Holocaust included, for example, the use of trains, to desperately overcrowded trains, to move Armenians from the interior of the Ottoman Empire to essentially the killing fields of the deserts of Syria, often using not just cattle box cars, but sheep box cars, so that the Armenians would have to be hunched over for these endless train rides. And then, of course, there were the methods of killing. Most of the Armenians, first the men would be disarmed, and then the men would be killed. They would either be massacred by neighbors in what were called chites, or sort of killing parties, or by Turkish soldiers or gendarmes. Then the women and the men, the women and the children, would be marched into the desert, where they would die in droves, either from dysentery, exposure, dehydration, or starvation. They would be raped. Often the women would simply kill themselves rather than, drag their dying children or their dead children a step further into the morass and this innermost ring of Dante's Inferno. One particular snippet I will share with you. This was from 1919. It was an interview with a Turkish gendarme, and he said with great pride that they had really good bullets and they had really good guns, and he knew how powerful their rifles were because one bullet could kill 10 Armenian women if you lined them up tits to back.
We should say that at the center of this story is also a love story.
Yes, it is. I did not want this book to be, one agony after another. It is first and foremost a love story, the story of Elizabeth Endicott, a 22-year-old graduate of Mount Holyoke College, and Armin Petrosian, an Armenian engineer in Syria who is trying to find his wife and his infant daughter, who he's pretty sure have died, but he can't help but hold out hope. I love stories. I love big, sweeping historical love stories, whether it's Atonement or Captain Corelli's Mandolin. And I wanted this book to be sort of a piece with them because they're just among my favorite books. And so, yes, that's a big, big part of the story, their love story.
And there is also something about love stories set against the backdrop of war, be they things like the Armenian Genocide or the larger world wars, that somehow amps up the emotion, that amps up the stakes that are always there in the story.
Doesn't it? You're absolutely right. It certainly makes the drama more poignant and more powerful. And I hope this does have a lot of really interesting characters, including, the Turkish physician who is ably and wonderfully trying to care for the Armenian orphans, or the Turkish soldier who's working with some German engineers to try and get evidence of the what we have now called a genocide, thanks to Polish scholar Raphael Lemkin, out of Turkey.
And in fact, there were Turks that stood up to the genocide. Few and far between, but they were some.
Absolutely. I mean, it's important. Yes, for example, my grandmother, Haygu Bakhçalyan, her father, my great-grandfather, provided horses to the Turkish cavalry in May of 1915. Rather than buy the horses from him, as they had in the past, they simply shot him, confiscated the herd, and confiscated all of the family property, including the apartment where they lived in Constantinople. So Haygu and her mother were sheltered for the next 3 years of the war by a Turkish Muslim family.
Talk a little bit about the time that you spent researching this and the time that you spent, as you say, last year going over there.
Yeah. I always do an enormous amount of homework for a book, and this book was no exception. I was fascinated by the primary sources that remain. I was fascinated by a lot of the great fiction. And there is some wonderful fiction that has sprung up out of the genocide, books by Franz Werfel and Carol Edgarian and Mark Mustian and Nancy Krikorian. And I have to send out big props to a great friend of mine and a genocide scholar and the editor of the Armenian Weekly, Hatshik Muradian. Hatshik is actually doing his PhD dissertation right now on Deir el-Zor, which is in some ways the Armenian Auschwitz. About 450,000 Armenian women and children perished in that corner of Syria in 1915 and 1916.
And this was the area in the northern Syrian desert that you were talking about earlier.
That's precisely right, yep. And Hatshik was just wonderful, constantly suggesting things I should read and finding these unbelievably obscure accounts. I remember one he found to me about the role of the Baghdad Railway in the transportation of Armenians between Ankara and Adana. It was just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the Germans and how they viewed this, their role during this in the run-up to World War One.
The Germans were allied with the Ottoman Empire in World War One, and by the standards of Germany, the Ottoman Empire was technologically primitive. So there were a lot of German engineers who were helping the Ottoman Empire rapidly expand the railways, first of all east toward the Caucasus Mountains and the Russian front, and southeast through the Middle East against the British, Australians, and New Zealanders. And the Germans were among the witnesses to the genocide. And there are telegrams and letters that remain from German engineers and from German councils in the provinces who are begging their superiors in Germany to stop the madness. There's one from, I believe it was Walter Rossler, who was the German consul in Aleppo, who was saying in essence that no civilized country would treat people the way the Turks are. We need to stop this. And then there was a German nurse named Armin Wegner who received a medal for his work in Poland on the Russian front in 1914, and in 1915 was sent to the Middle East, who was surreptitiously, illegally taking photographs of Armenian survivors and deportees and victims, the dead of the genocide, until he was found out and was sent as punishment to a cholera ward, where, of course, he got cholera. And yet he did. He survived the war, and his photographs are some of the only photographs that remain of the genocide.
What did you discover in your research about what the Turkish agenda was against the Armenians?
Well, one of the things that the Turkish scholar, Taner Akçam, just a brilliant, brilliant genocide scholar, has observed is that a genocide or a Holocaust doesn't begin overnight. There's a run-up to it. It's a gradual process. And there were a number of factors that led the Young Turks to finally order the annihilation and the extermination of the Armenians. First of all, there were the disastrous Balkan Wars that preceded the First World War, which led to a flood of Muslim refugees into Turkey proper. They had to be resettled somewhere. Secondly, there was the Young Turks' fear that their empire was absolutely collapsing around them. All of a sudden, there are the Australians and the New Zealanders really near Constantinople in Gallipoli. The Russians are constantly pressing into eastern Turkey. And I think they just began to panic. They began to panic that the Armenians might side with the Russians, which the fact is they were not. They were not rebelling. There was the fear that the Armenians in western Turkey might uprise to join the Christian Australians and New Zealanders trying to push up the Gallipoli Peninsula. There was no plan of that whatsoever. And finally, there was the need for something to turn into the demons in the same way that Hitler blamed all of Germany's travails after the First World War on Jewish citizens of Europe. All of a sudden, it was easy to blame the Armenians. They were the Christian minority. They were often the entrepreneurs. And they had such profound connections with the West that in 1917, Talat Pasha brought in Robert Morgenthau, the American ambassador to Turkey, into his office before the U.S. had entered the war, and said, I want a list of all the Armenian policyholders with New York life insurance and Metropolitan Life Insurance, because they're all dead now, and their descendants are all dead now, and so that means that all of their assets go to the Turkish government. Morgenthau stormed out of the office, as enraged as he ever was in the midst of this debacle.
Talk a little bit about your grandparents' house. In many ways, kind of the motivation for what becomes the Ottoman annex for Laura's grandparents.
Yeah, that the Ottoman annex, that is what my Swedish mother called her in-law's house, the Ottoman annex of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She called it that because of the plush oriental carpets, my Armenian grandmother's ornate, intricate lace work, and the bookshelves filled with books in a language and alphabet I couldn't even begin to decipher. That house was so magic to me as a little boy and so wonderful. It always had the enveloping, magical aroma of lamb and mint, because almost until the day he died, my grandfather had a lamb chop for breakfast. That was a king meal.
Hmm. Chris Bojalian, the book is The Sandcastle Girls. Chris, as always, it's been a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Jeff, I thank you so much.